This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. Your guest hosts for today are Kristen Lalonde and Thomas Malik from the Secret Stacks podcast, where they talk about comics in libraries. And their guests are Thomas Malik and Kristen Lalonde from the Secret Stacks podcast, where they talk about comics in libraries. That I feel like I just said that. You can find them at secretstacks.com or subscribe via iTunes or your podcast app of choice.
Hello, and welcome to Circulating Ideas. This is your host, Kristen Lalonde, and here I am here with my guest, Thomas Malik, co-host of the Secret Stacks podcast.
I'm also here to welcome you to Circulating Ideas, Thomas Malik, your host, with my guest, Kristen Lalonde, co-host of The Secret Stacks.
Yeah!
Two for one.
You get double for your money, guys. So today, we are going to be interviewing each other on some pretty interesting topics. Of course, being the people that we are, the topics are going to generally circulate around, they're going to circulate around being librarians and comics and graphic novels, because that's pretty much our whole deal.
So set your Teslas to autopilot, because you're going to want to listen to this.
Yeah, good thing Teslas are noiseless, so you can listen to the podcast real good. I think that's true, right? About Teslas?
Yeah, they're very quiet.
Okay, that's good. Good job, Elon Musk.
All right, I'm going to kick it off with our first question. Kristen, what are some formative experiences you had with comics?
Well, Thomas, I kind of talked about this a little bit in the first episode of our podcast, but when I was growing up, I used to read a lot of newspaper comics, a lot of Garfields. I also read a lot of Archies because that's what was available, and like grocery stores and stuff when I was growing up. But, and I don't think I talked about this, really the one that made the biggest impact on me was The Far Side by Gary Larson. I collected a lot of his books, and I actually attempted to draw my own comics. Like him, like, you know, like just the one gag sort of stuff. And they were bad, and I don't know how to draw very well. You know, I thought it was funny. But truly, it was like Gary Larson, the Far Side were probably my first comic that I just loved to death, that I just wanted to, be that. And I tried to make my own to do that. Just the humor was offbeat, but it's also very funny, and I enjoyed it quite a bit, and I collect all of his books. I didn't actually get into monthly comics until I became older. When I was in college, I read a lot of some graphic novels and stuff at the college library, Dykes to Watch Out For and stuff like that, but really, it was The Far Side. It was probably my most formative. It was so close to my own humor, and just made me want to know more about comics in general. What about you, Thomas? What were your formative comics experience?
Going through a grocery store and having these giant, you know, Archie, Jughead, Betty and Veronica little double digests, you know, sitting out at the checkout lane and just being able to point, being like, oh, I want to read this. And my parents entertaining that very much. And then over the summers, you know, having this stack of once read books and then being like, oh, I think I'm going to reread all of my Archie comics today. Yeah, lots of comics that kids from that bunch of 90s kids would be all about. I tended to attach to them. I read a lot of Mad Magazine. I loved all the goofy drawings and caricatures of movie stars.
I really liked the Mad Magazine stuff too, even though I knew a lot of it, I didn't really understand the references they were making.
Yeah, I would often not get certain dirty jokes, or if something had an acronym in it, I'd be like, You know, I'm in fourth grade. What am I supposed to know about this?
Is this about politics? I don't really know.
Is this a drug thing? Drugs are bad. Okay, next joke. like my first manga experience probably came from the pages of a Nintendo Power, from like the old Mario and Zelda comics they'd have in those. Tons of newspaper comics. So everything you said about, and like going to the library and you go to like the 741.5s. Is that right?
Yes.
And there's a bunch of Farsides and Garfield and Dilberts and For Better or For Worses, that sort of thing.
And they're still very popular with kids.
Yeah.
Even the, like, the Garfield books. I think what was the first one was, what, published in 81 or something? Maybe early 80s? Kids love Garfield books, and they will love them until the end of time. That's just something about Garfield kids cannot get enough of.
It's still, I still see it today. I'll take kids to the comics area and I'll recommend stuff, and they're like, yeah, but what about Garfield? And of course, Peanuts and Calvin and Hobbes, but everyone loved Peanuts and Calvin and Hobbes, so.
I feel like Peanuts and Calvin and Hobbes are like your, what's your favorite movie? Oh, is it Citizen Kane and Shawshank Redemption? Those are like
and
that.
And The Godfather. And
for newspaper comics. We're like, oh, well, of course, Calvin and Hobbes.
It's like the hidden part of your education.
Yeah.
Like these little cartoon characters who tell you like, okay, but here are all the disappointments that are coming as you age.
Yeah, well, you know, I got a newspaper subscription at my house, and I'm reading the newspaper comics again. And the Peanuts, I never really realized, because I always read the Sundays, that the story in Peanuts is, an actual continuing story from day to day. Right now, he's going through when the little redheaded girl next door moves away. I'm like, oh, it's actually just a continuation of the story every day. I didn't know that's what happened because we only got the Sunday newspaper when I was growing up. And, you know, when you get the books, and I'm like, oh, sure, it makes sense that it's a sequential story. But most of the newspaper comics now are gag-a-day ones instead of an actual sequential story. Back in the olden times, that's not how it was.
I remember in my teens, I read Foxtrot. And I think his name's Jason.
Yeah, little nerdy kid.
He had a crude comic that he drew called Slugman. And I wasn't into superhero comics at all, but I thought it was really endearing, the idea of like, oh, you can just draw your own crude comic and have it be this little pocket universe of fictional characters. And so I tried to do my own version called Worm Man, and then I tried to draw little spiky-haired anime characters all over the place, and a lot of ill-thought-out stories came out of that. And we'll never speak of this again.
Right. Well, like I said, I used to try to draw my own Far Side-related comics, but it's like, it's hard to have observational humor when you're in middle school. It's like, I know nothing about the world, so my observations are pretty, like, oh, it's crazy stuff going on at school, pretty much. Or parents just don't understand. Those are pretty much my two areas of knowledge at the time. I feel like a lot of people can probably relate. The nice thing about comics, and I mean any art form, really, is when you're just like, yes, I can do that. I can make my own stories. I can make art instead of just consuming an art. That's always nice when that happens. Question two for you, Thomas.
Okay.
If you were a demigod, what would you change about the comics industry or the culture?
Well, about the industry, I would break up Diamond Distributors' monopoly on comics distribution. Slightly less boring answer, maybe I would tweak the history of comics so that superheroes were not the dominant archetype in single issue sales. Because like there are graphic novels of all kinds, and we're in a new golden age of indie publishers and, you know, Cinderella stories of, oh, this artist studied for 10 years and then made a masterpiece. But you still get all these people putting superheroes on top of the sales, and it's very weird. Was it Chris Ware who had a line about, you know, imagine if the first movie was about pilgrims, and then every year a dozen movies about pilgrims came out? And if you said anything about it, everyone would be like, "Why? What do you have against pilgrims? They're good stories. Have you read them?" I definitely feel this in my... All right. But then here's what I did really dislike personally in comics culture, which is that a lot of online community and online conversation is often driven, at least in the corners I go to, it always seems to be driven by a bunch of retailers who determine their conversations on the basis of what sells well for them and what do those customers who are making those purchases like. And the whole context of what's a good story, what could draw in a new customer, what would a family like to enjoy together, like, I don't see that come up so much. And so, like, when I got to meet a bunch of Valkyries, for example, and I get to, you know, hear about their organization, I love hearing about that kind of stuff, because it's like, here's a bunch of retailers talking about how do we grow the industry, how do we knock our customers' socks off. Let's say I've hand sold these 5 series from Boom to them. Are there any Image comics that could also fit the bill? And it's like, it's more about enjoying the comic than just saying, oh, this comic did well, good, next story. And like, well, hold on, we didn't even talk about the character, we didn't say whether it was good or not, we didn't... I want everyone to nerd out as hard as I do, basically.
Yeah, well, it's hard when it's like the basis of whether something is good is not necessarily... I mean, you could also see for, like, take movies, for example. It's like, oh, well, how come this movie didn't get an Oscar? It made a lot of money. I'm like, well, just because it made a lot of money does not mean it's necessarily a good story or a good piece of art. Like, you know, it's not quite, if you're asking, oh, which comic did really well, that's one question. But if you're asking, oh, what's a really good story for kids 8 to 11 who like dinosaurs? It's like, well, this book sold well. It's like, that's not a good answer for that. You're not really talking about the story.
But Kristen, if you were a demigod, what would you change about the comics industry and culture?
Well, one thing that, I don't know, Pete, I think is kind of annoying is how, I guess, I feel like it's kind of a backlash sort of thing where they're like, oh, comics, they're not just for kids anymore. So we make them these are adults. These are adult stories. Where I feel like the comics industry a lot of times had left out a lot of kids as their, as their audience in an attempt, like, these are adult stories. These characters for adults. And I feel like now they're trying a little harder to make more kid-friendly stuff. I mean, Boom's doing a really good job. Top Shelf has a lot of stuff out, but just generally, it's hard. When I've gone to a couple of comics events and things, and I've talked to some people, and it's like, I feel like there's a big disconnect between libraries and the comics industry, where a lot of times with libraries, we have a hard time. It's like, we want stuff for kids. It's not just like, you know, really corny. We want, like, good kid stuff, and especially, like, for superheroes. We like some actual kid-appropriate superhero stuff, and there are a few, but there's really not a ton.
You could open a can of worms with that topic with children and young adult literature in general, where someone always has to belabor the point and be like, well, who's to say a kid can't handle XYZ? And it's like, you know what we mean. Come on.
Yeah, like, come on. And, you know, I think DC is doing a pretty good job making kid-friendly versions of their characters, but I also think it gets really confusing for kids because, like, oh, I want to read some Batman stories. But, okay, well, we have some Batman stuff. majority of it is in the adult section, and they're like, well, why can't I read that Batman? Because like, that's adult situations Batman. You want to read these Batman. It's like, it's hard for them to like, well, isn't it all Batman? And then if you're talking to parents, they don't, you know, isn't it all Batman is fine? Like, no, not all Batman is not fine.
Although there's plenty of kid-friendly stuff, but if you don't have, you know, one of us around to parse it out.
Right. Like, who's, like, you get someone comes in, like, I want some Batman versus Superman books.
That came up on Twitter a few months ago. Someone said, yeah, there's a kid who wants, they would need child-level reading material for Batman v Superman. I'm like, but they don't fight a lot in stories that I would give a 5-year-old.
I think that was a conversation that we had, Thomas, actually. I think that was me who had brought that up, because that happened.
Okay. All roads lead back to Kristen.
Because, yeah, I mean, I'm like, I don't have anything to give you. Because, I mean, in the kid-friendly versions, I guess they get along, you know, they don't fight each other. At worst case is that, oh, the Batman's kind of grumpy and then Superman's really upbeat. And then, their personalities clash in that way. But that's, like, it.
If you go back to the Silver Age, they frame each other for murder every other day.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to remember the Batman the Brave and the Bold, which is my favorite version of Batman. They get along, but they also don't. They have conflicting personalities. Like, Batman's a night person, Superman's a morning person, etc. So, it's like, oh, you know, but at the end of the day, they're buds or whatever. But they're like, oh, I want the book that's Batman v Superman is based off of. I'm like, that's not a thing. All the stuff where they fight each other is really not appropriate for your age level. But I was like, how do I explain that? Because it's just, I wish, like I said, I feel like in the effort to be like, no, superhero books are serious business. Adult situations, they're not kids stuff. I feel like it's like, oh, you're just pushing away kids from this stuff, and then you have to go back and then retro. It's like, no, wait, but it actually, it is also for that too, and then you have to come back and make kid friendly stuff. And I think Marvel could do better about making more kid friendly Marvel property stuff. DC does a better job, I think.
Well, they put out that thing, oh boy. Dustin Nguyen did the artwork, and it's like if the DC characters went to grade school.
Yeah.
Or something. That series is adorable.
It is. It is adorable. You're not talking about JL8, are you?
Not JL8, although I enjoy that comic too. No, this is a book, I want to say it went out through Scholastic, where it's like their school detectives.
Yeah, those are
or something.
Cute. Yeah, and then, well, they also have the Titans.
Yeah, Little Gotham.
Batman,
Brave, and the Bold.
And now they've got the DC Superhero Girls books, which actually I read the one for Free Comic Day, and I thought it was adorable. I enjoyed that story quite a bit. Marvel doesn't really do that, which is
right. That's one more thing I would change, and it's related to that Superhero Girls book, is I had a Free Comic Book Day event, and there was a boy who's very bright, very enthusiastic, very friendly, but when he saw all the comics that were out, he's like, oh, this is awesome, you got this series. He gets to Superhero Girls. He says, what's this doing here? I said, oh, it's a bunch of female DC characters. It's like they're all teamed up, sort of. And he goes, I hate this. This shouldn't be here. I can't stand it. You know, I was like, why would anyone read this? And I'm like, well, they're just, some people prefer to see these characters. Like, you have your books over there, and they have those characters, and some people like these. And if you tried it, maybe you'd like this, too. You should read it first. He said, no way. I can't stand this. I can't. And he wasn't angry, but like he just had it in his head. It's like, oh, a book starring all girls. That must be like you're ruining something. I'm like, nothing's being ruined. You can have an all boys. You can have an all girls. You can have a boys and girls. You can do any different configuration. It can still be good. You can have your old Ghostbusters. You can have your new Ghostbusters. Yeah, they can all live together. Yeah, it's like whatever the culture that's out there that tries to teach young people, you know, you have to section off the things you enjoy. It's like, no, the more you let in, the better it gets. Variety is the spice of life here.
Yeah. And I can also say it's not just the kids who do that. I feel like parents also are like, no, that's not for you. This is for girls. This is not for you. I've also seen the opposite. Like, oh, these are boy books. Like, don't say that. Don't say something's a girl book or something's a boy book. But yeah, as a kid, you know, say kids say it, but I also, parents, I've seen parents say that too. It's like, come on. And I don't want to be that person. I'm like, no, no, don't say it. It's a thing. But, you know, it's like, don't. You're warping your kid to think bad things.
Yeah, and then they're going to say something mean to someone else, and then they're going to feel like they're not even allowed to talk about how much they enjoy something.
I wish if people said all ages, people were like, oh, those are for, you know, those are immature stories. Like, no, it's just they're not extremely gritty, you know, terrible things are happening stories.
What have you recommended on Secret Stacks before that you're still enjoying now?
Squirrel Girl! I feel like Squirrel Girl is just continually top class. Just, I love the story. I love the story from beginning to end. I don't feel like it's dropped off in quality at all. I love Ryan North. I love Erica Henderson's art. I love the humor. I love the way she solves problems. I love the villains. I love her friends. I love Squirrel Girl so much. It just continues to be great. I continue to talk about it. Can I also mention one that I've recommended that now I'm a little more skeptical about recommending?
Ooh, which one?
Rat Queens.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, I love the story and I like the characters, but sketchy, sketchy business going on with in the background with old what's-his-face being wife beater and also secretly being involved in the process, even though we were told he wasn't. So now I just feel bad that I ever recommended the book to anybody.
Yeah, even at ALA, during comic recommendation conversations, when people would bring up Rat Queens, there was always this asterisk on the end. And people who didn't know, you could see it in their eyes. They'd be like, what's... Well, it's like, you keep saying the series is so great. Why would I not want it to be great? And then someone has to explain. Yeah. Well, then they replaced that artist, but then they misled that artist because they brought the original back and they didn't tell her.
Right. And then from what I understood, he was being all puppet master or whatever behind the scenes.
And then his wife had to blog about him and say, here's what he's really up to. And
yeah. Sketchy business, which is so sad because I really love that book. And I've recommended it to so many people, and I love D&D, and it's just a great, fun story, and he had to ruin it by being a piece of garbage.
There are a couple of comics authors that I will not give my money to. because there have been enough stories about them where I'm like, I don't know that I want your comic to succeed where someone else's fails. Them's the breaks. Sorry. I'm voting with my conscience and my wallet. Sorry.
Right. Vote with my dollars. It's pretty much what I can do here. But Ryan North and Erica Henderson continue to be great human beings.
Thumbs
so
up.
I feel perfectly fine spending my money on them. What about you, Thomas? Anything still holds up really well that you recommended?
There are several series that going into volumes 2 and 3, I'm always like, oh man, if I didn't recommend this before, I would have recommended it now. And I recently finished the final issue of Divinity 2 from Valiant Comics. And when I did my deep dive into Valiant earlier this year, Divinity Volume 1, that was like one of those, it did everything it needed to do to convert me into a Valiant fan. Like, it showed me how imaginative their universe was. It introduced me to several other characters that made me go, maybe I should read their book. This looks kind of interesting. It showed me how like the 4-issue format can tell an expansive yet self-contained story. It did so much, and that's before I even comment on the story and art, really. So when Divinity 2 got announced, I was like, you know, am I going to have the same feelings toward this? And of course, it can't capture lightning in a bottle the way it does when you're introduced to a whole universe. But it was such a good sequel, Kristen. I'm all about, and Divinity 3 comes out this winter, and just, this is one of the best things Valiant has going. You have Abram Adams, you know, Russian cosmonaut, comes back with the powers of a god. Divinity 2, his partner, spoiler alert, his partner from the original space mission, Mishka, she comes back, and she is super communist, and she wants to use her powers to just, because they basically have the powers of gods. Like, they can straight up alter reality right in front of you. And one of my absolute favorite moments in the Valiant universe comes from the Imperium series, when Divinity meets the equivalent of evil Professor X, Toyo Harada. Not a single punch or dumb violent thing is exchanged. Instead, I know I'm jumping series here, but Toyo cannot fight Divinity. Divinity simply warps time and reality around himself. So that if the fight's about to begin, instead he gets jumped in time to after the fight ended. And if he tries to use some sort of weird mind trick to try to warp himself back, it's like Divinity will just toss him back to before he ever knocked down Divinity's door. And he's like, why can't I meet this guy? And it's like, oh, it turns out Divinity already met you, and now he's making it so that you never have the sensation of meeting him. And I'm like, this is so brilliant. I'm loving reading this. You're fighting a concept. How do you even do that? Kristen.
Yes.
If you could turn back time.
If I could find a way.
What would you change about the Secret Stacks podcast? Whether it's at the beginning, middle, current, an episode you didn't like, anything.
Okay. This is going to sound just extremely, I don't know, non-important, I guess. But I'm like, why do we always record at the end of the month? Because at the end of the month, I am always in the worst mood. Every end of the month, I said it's just the way things are. When my mood cycle through, I'm like, the last week of the month or the last few days of the month, I'm like, God, I am so crabby. I'm in such a bad mood. I'm like, why did we decide that we're going to record at the end of every month when I am in like my peak crabby bad moodness? So it's like, you know, that's a very specific thing for me. But yeah, that's my one thing. Like, every time, like, why am I so crabby right now? I'm like, oh yeah, it's the end of the month. And we're going to record this thing right when I'm crabby. I don't know if anyone can tell, because I'm very personal and lovable person. But It's always, the end of the month is always when I'm super crappy. What about you, Thomas?
All right, this is going to sabotage the next question a bit, but part of me wishes we had more regular guests, or like even a recurring guest where it's like every other month, it's, oh, let's check in with so-and-so who specializes in this.
Right.
But I enjoy talking to you, Kristen.
Yeah, I enjoy talking to you, Thomas.
So, like, the couple of times we have had guests, I'm like, oh, cool, we've got this unique, different show, we have a new perspective, you know, we can throw their face out there and go, hey, here, you know, get a load of this person. But when we don't have a guest, there's also that sigh of relief of, oh, I don't have to coordinate a third person.
Right. It is complicated.
Their schedule. I mean, their Skype name and their internet connection and...
Right. How's it like, oh, is your, what's going on over there? And then, yeah, it's way more complicated with a third person. But, yeah, you do get that perspective. Cause, you know, surprisingly, Thomas and I don't know everything. It's just, I know, I hate telling people that. I hate to shatter their images of the two
Even
of us.
The sun casts a shadow.
But, yeah, so... Yeah, I totally, in theory, be like, yeah, I mean, because we know a lot of cool people who do interesting things in the world of libraries and comics. But coordinating schedules is a pain in the butt.
Yeah, and this podcast, like, Kristen and I, you know, we're Facebook friends. We take part in some of the same Twitter conversations. But doing this monthly podcast, it's like we're pen pals.
Yeah.
And we catch... To have someone that you only call once a month with the specific purpose of recording that conversation, like, that's a very special ritual.
Yeah. Catching up on life, what we're reading, all that good stuff. It's nice. So, yeah, it's just a nice, you know, it's nice. And it's like, it's not to say having our guests. Was bad. It was really good. I enjoyed all of our guests.
I look forward to having more guests, even.
Yeah. And like I said, they were all great, wonderful people. And added to the conversation, and we learned a lot, and they were perfect. They were just awesome. But yeah, it is a lot. It's a lot. It's nice, and it's nice to talk to Thomas during every month. It's, you know, less complicated.
Yeah, compared to Steve's format, every episode, you're getting something different.
Yeah. It's a lot of work for Steve.
Yeah, the new versus the familiar, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, I said Steve could probably tell you complications of interviewing somebody who you don't know what their mic setup is like, or their internet connection, or their computer situation, or whatever.
Or you take some time off and you ask your other podcasting buddies to fill in for an episode.
Yeah. Begging them because they're so great. And they're like, okay, Steve, we'll do you a favor one more time. And he's like, oh, you're the best. You're like, you're so good and the greatest. And I'm like, yeah, we know, Steve. Calm down. Okay, Thomas.
Yeah.
If you could invite and talk to anyone on the show, who would it be? We were just talking about having guests. Who would your ideal guest would be? Living or dead?
Living or... that makes...
Yeah. Oh,
living or dead.
Living or dead. What would you say? How about living and dead? You get two choices. You get a dead one and you get a live one.
Okay. Dead, I'm going to keep this on the comics topic. I would not mind meeting Harvey Pekar.
Ooh.
I mean, he's been interviewed a lot, so I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, whatever question I have, he's probably answered it before, but, you know, you want to talk to, you know, when someone has profiled so many other people in his art, you kind of want to meet them and then see if a story you have or just the way you carry yourself, if that gets the gears turning in their head. And you're like, oh, wait, he hasn't seen this story yet. And then just, you know, talking about how his life is gone, because there's always his real life versus how he portrays it in his American Splendor comics.
Right.
And then he branched off into a lot of nonfiction and biographies of other people. And I wanted to ask him what the research process for that was like, because he used his library.
He sure did.
He valued that library card.
Yeah.
And then Living is kind of a combination. I would say Zainab Akhtar, who wrote for Comics and Cola. I thought she was a very bright voice in comics, you know, blogging and journalism and criticism. And then she seems to be taking kind of a break. And now she's putting out these, like comics mystery boxes that you can subscribe to. But I've always enjoyed her writing. I hope she keeps writing. And I'd love to have a conversation with her. And then on like the fun, mean side would be, Abe Khosla, who writes the, Twist Street Tumblr. And he wrote that thing for the Comics Journal about the 2015 year in review in comics, where he just rounded up every scandal, controversy, dumb decision, and just he just laid it all out, and just in the driest, not meanest, but just the most take no prisoners style. Where it's like he just was not suffering any fools on it. He just called people out for the entire article. I just like to see him zero in on some stuff from 2016 while he's at it.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
But who would you invite?
Living or dead and dead. Living and or dead,
yeah.
Dead? Abraham Lincoln! What do you think he thought about comic books, Thomas? Do they have comics in the... When did Cats and Jammer Kids come out?
I mean, there were caricatures in newspapers by then.
True, there were political cartoons. He probably hated comics then.
Yeah, they're always like throwing up paragraphs of text.
He probably wasn't a big fan then, really. If you brought him on, he'd be like, those are terrible. I hate those. They made fun of me a lot. Made me feel bad.
It's like Abe saying that this log house is going to be the new perfect union and then it collapses or something.
Yeah. Or like, oh, he's trying to build. I don't remember. I saw one once. I was a history major, ladies and gentlemen.
Like,
I saw
not so great political metaphors flying out. Like, his policy is a house, and the house is fallen.
Yeah, and then they write the exact thing they're talking about on the metaphor, like, in case you don't get it. Like, this is the American public, and the axe is his policy, right? Policy right on there.
I'd love for Lincoln to read a comic about Lincoln and then tell us how wrong it was.
Yeah, I bet there's there's probably... Oh, man. So I was going through Hoopla... You know, because I read a lot of Hoopla now, because I'm not at a public library anymore. So now I have to go there like a citizen, and it's really convenient to have Hoopla around. But I like nonfiction graphic novels a lot of the time. There's a ton of these biography graphic novels on there. Pretty sure Abraham Lincoln is one of them. But also so was, like... Ryan Reynolds was one. It was just like a picture of him without a shirt on that someone drew on the cover. It's completely weird.
It's accurate. That's pretty much his career in a nutshell.
That's who my living person would be. I'd interview Ryan Reynolds and ask him about... I wouldn't ask him about Deadpool. I wouldn't talk to him about Deadpool at all. Just about his graphic novel biography. He's like, I read this... Would you like to talk about it? No, my actual living person, I'd like to talk to my best friend, Jeff Johns, from DC Comics. He was a very nice man when I met him before, and I think it'd be nice to talk to, because he's a nice young man. But pretty much I'd talk to anybody. And also, it'd be nice for a dead person Jack Kirby was a crazy man, wasn't he? He'd be fun to talk to.
I would go after young Jack Kirby.
Okay, not old Jack Kirby.
Like height of his powers, Jack Kirby.
Sure, yeah.
Mind you, he was always at the height of his powers, but...
Yeah.
I feel like old Jack Kirby would be a lot more bitter about how the industry treated him on his way out.
That might make a more interesting podcast, then.
That's true.
Yeah. We have Jack Kirby on. We have Jack Kirby's ghost to come on and, you know, talk about what grinds his gears and just lay into everybody. That'd be pretty great. I'd listen to that.
If you get young Jack Kirby, you can have him change the thing yelling "my sweet Aunt Petunia" to "my sweet Aunt Kristen."
Yeah! I'd love to mess with, you know, the fabric of time.
Kristen?
Yes.
I got a serious librarianship question here for you.
Okay, I'm ready.
Can you identify a turning point in your library career when you knew this was the industry for you? Like, you knew you had the chops, you knew you belonged, you knew you were proficient, any of those?
I think, because originally, I was not going to be a librarian originally. Like, working in a library was just going to be a thing I did until I went to grad school and got my PhD, and then I was going to teach. That was, like, my thing that I was planning to do. I was going to teach Middle Eastern Studies. I was going to go get my degree at the American University in Cairo. And I volunteered at and then got a job in the library at the Arab American Ish Museum. And I'm like, okay, well, since I'm here, go to library school, get this degree, and whatever, while I'm here. But somewhere along the way, and I think it was when I was helping somebody do their research for, I don't remember if it was like a master's thesis or some kind of a PhD thesis. I was helping them with their research, and then they thanked me in their thesis, where I'm just like, yeah, this is actually a thing I'm really good at. Like, the thing I really came to understand was I would have been awful in academia because I can't really stay interested in one topic for that long. Where that's kind of the whole thing for getting your PhD is, like, you make it because you are able to stay interested in this one niche subject that you've dedicated your professional life to. For me, I like to dabble. I like to learn about everything, like absolutely everything. I'm one of those people where when I watch something on TV, I always have Wikipedia up on, like, I was watching Perot recently, and it was an episode where they were in Rhodes, and I was like, I want to learn about the history of Rhodes, and, like, oh, is it Greek? Is it Turkish? Is it this? Is it that? I just want to learn something about everything. And then I realized that's exactly what being a librarian is. I get to, every time someone comes to me with a question, I get to delve into that question and learn about it. Because I want to know. Like, I get to learn more about this subject. And I get to help people with my wide, I don't have a deep knowledge of a lot of things, but I have a very shallow knowledge of a million things, which is exactly what I like. It's like, oh yes, I know something about that. I know where to look, and I can give you this information, and I love helping people find that information. And just at my new job, where I'm actually a hospital librarian, I help people get articles, and it just brings me joy when people are like, oh my gosh, can't believe you found this stuff, or I can't believe you got all this stuff. And, you know, the journey of me finding out, because I don't have a background in health, but I was learning about, for example, I was doing a research project for somebody in administration about the socks that you get at the hospital that have little grippy things on the bottom and whether there's any research supporting if they prevent people from falling in the hospital. It turns out it's a very controversial issue. And it was very fun to look up all this stuff, and I was reading about it, and it was very interesting. Totally not a thing I would have thought to look up before. But it was super interesting. And I'm like, yes, this is why I do this. This is my thing. Looking up stuff, learning things, exposing myself to new things every day. So, that's my answer, Thomas. What about you?
I would start by first naming when I was not at that junction. I started as a professional librarian October 11th, 2010. I'll never forget that because the years I spent at that specific library are special to me. But I remember my first month or so as a librarian, I didn't know what I was doing, and not in like the cute millennial adulting, like not that weird kind of phase that people refer to. But I mean, I would be at my little desk in the back and I'd be like, no emails. All right. Any teens in the building? No teens in the building? Okay. All right. Stacks are clean. Okay, good. Anyone at CERC need help? No? All right. Okay. It's all good. And then, thanks to some training, some advice, some influence from coworkers, and a whole lot of public interaction, by the end of the year, I transitioned. I can't trace it to a specific day, but I know I had a lot of days like this where I would just go into eager beaver mode and, oh, this person needs help doing this on a computer. Okay, did it, done. Oh, there's a parent over here who needs, you know, 5 books about dinosaurs. Got them, done. Next question. Oh, my hold came in, but I don't see it on the shelf. Let me go track it down. Done. Oh, there's a parent on the phone with a question about your teen program tomorrow night. Answer, done. There was just some moment that I can't quantify it, but where I went from like zero effectiveness to I'm running on all cylinders. I am here to help every last human being who crosses my path. And it was a very satisfying feeling. And it's the sort of feeling that makes the day go by really quickly. And then when you leave at night, you're like, you know, I can tally that up in my head. I helped a lot of people and I got people answers. And if I couldn't get them the answer, I was able to refer them to a coworker or a resource or give them the phone number of someone at one of the branches who really specializes in this sort of thing. And so it's just a very empowering feeling when you're that conduit for other people. And it starts as nothing, which is the part that's my letter to a young librarian. It's like, you're going to sit at a desk and just blank for a few days. And that's okay, because you're going to build up all the connections you need. Like, just be helpful, volunteer for what you need to, you know, be as useful as you can, learn as much as you can, and just take your opportunities as they come.
Good advice. Because, yeah, you won't know anything until it's going to take a little while until you get your bearings and you're like, wait a minute. I mean, I feel like as long as your goal is to help people, everything will kind of fall into place. You know, no matter what it is, you're like, okay, I'm here to help this person. Or who will help people with whatever. It'll all come eventually to you. Just in my case, the nice thing about being a librarian, if you have a desire to learn and you have a curiosity about the world, being a librarian is the perfect job for you. Because you get to learn. Everyone comes in with something different they need help with, gives you an opportunity to learn about that too. It's pretty great.
All right, I have a sub-answer. I rolled back through the Rolodex of memories. All right. Part B, several months into my job, that spring, we have the sort of in-service staff day. We call it Customer Service Improvement Day. All the branches are closed. Do some trainings, do your spring cleaning, that sort of thing. And each of the full-time librarians at my library you know, we each had to lead something or present on something for the rest of the staff. And when the branch manager gave me the floor, this was like my first opportunity to actually address everyone at that branch at once. So it's not like just the night crew, just the day crew or anything. So she's like, okay, well, I'm going to give the floor over to Thomas. And then I stepped up in front of everyone. I said, it's time for everyone to listen to me, the least experienced person in the room. And it got a laugh, and it also lowered everyone's guard. And then we did a training exercise together. So like that was my opportunity to take ownership of the fact that, like, you know, for some of the people in that room, my boss just said, okay, we're going to let Thomas speak. They've never met me, and it's been months just because we worked opposite schedules or something like that. So it's like, okay, now we're going to step in the room, take ownership of the fact that, hey, I'm still kind of new here, but hey, let's do this thing together and learn something about each other. And that was like a positive experience that helped meld us all.
Good stories, Thomas. Yeah! Well, good. Well, believe that's all we have for this episode of Circulating Ideas. I'd like to thank my guest, Thomas Malik, co-host of Secret Stacks, for talking to me today.
Well, the honor is all mine for being able to interview my guest, Kristen Lalonde.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. Steve will be back for future episodes, so don't worry, and hope you enjoy all of his other guests that he has. And enjoy, and if you have time or are interested, check out our podcast, Secret Stacks, and just go to our website, secretstacks.com, and check it out.
The Harvey-nominated secretstacks.com.
Yeah. Thanks, Thomas, for voting for us 1.5 million times.
Vote early, vote often.
Right? Have a great day.
See ya.
Circulating Ideas is produced by Steve Thomas in the suburbs of Atlanta. Find out more about the show at circulatingideas.com, including links to old episodes, transcripts, and how you can help support the show. You can find the show on Facebook at facebook.com/circulatingideas or follow it on Twitter at @circideas. To help others find the show, please rate and review the show on iTunes, Overcast, or your podcast app of choice, and keep circulating your ideas.
I had to stop myself from naming all of our topics we discussed because they might not all make the final cut.
That's true. Steve might cut quite a bit.